Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters Today, this February 8th, 2009. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580. Imagine if there were an economist who correctly anticipated the financial crisis in all its dimensions at the beginning, early on, before anyone else. In fact, when everyone else was in denial. And the same economist had also correctly anticipated, along with that, the housing crisis, which leads to the financial crisis, and the stock bubble of the late 1990s. Such an economist would be someone we'd like to have making decisions probably to understand our economy today. Well, we might not have that, but we do have him on our show. Dean Baker will be joining us today on Media Matters for the full hour, so sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. And in the meantime, before we get started, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
In October 2007, a group of 16 scholars from 11 American universities joined together to draft a communications policy agenda for the next administration. Last week, the Future of American Communications Working Group released its recommendations in a book called And Communications for All. Amit Schechter, an assistant professor of telecommunications at Penn State University, edited the book. Schechter believes that academics have an important role to play in telecommunications policymaking.
We are all funded by public money, and we owe allegiance only to the public. The work of academia, when it can, should be within the public domain, and since all of us, in one way or another, are policy researchers, we want to contribute to the policy debate our position as academics, which are arguments that can be substantiated, that are based on many years of study and research, and that do not represent a partisan or stakeholder's position.
The book covers issues like media ownership, broadband access, the wireline and wireless industries, cable, content issues, media representations of women and people of color, the role of public media, and protecting teenage privacy. Schechter says that no one idea in the book is radical, but the sum of its parts are unique.
The radical thing about it is that there is such agreement among the authors of this book about the principles of the new policy. And I think that that's radical in an academic world.
The authors of And Communications for All agree that the government needs to take an active role to ensure that Americans have access to telecommunications technologies. They also agree that uniform rules covering cable, telephone, and wireless will be much more efficient in providing better services to more people. And they all share the belief that the market is not always the answer to problems concerning crucial public infrastructure.
Telecommunication infrastructure doesn't only exist in order to serve markets. We believe that we need to create more competitive and fairer markets on the one hand, but we need to focus government policy on the creation of needed public goods and spaces where hyper-commercialism is not at the center, but actually at the sidelines.
Hate crimes against Latinos have risen nearly 40% since 2003. The National Hispanic Media Coalition wants to know whether a spike in anti-Latino hate speech on TV and radio, coming not just from the fringes but well-known talkers like Michael Savage and Rush Limbaugh, is contributing to the violence. Last week, the group called upon the Federal Communications Commission to investigate the relationship between hate speech and hate crimes.
This is a national epidemic. The growth is spurred each day by hate speech, distortion of facts, and anti-immigrant sentiment expressed on cable shows, local radio shows, and across the airwaves.
That's John Amaya of the Mexican-American Legal Defense Fund speaking about the effort last week in Washington.
The serious topic of immigration has been contaminated by hatred and racism, and it's created a toxic climate which fosters and condones violence and civil rights violations, all motivated by bigotry.
In addition to petitioning the FCC, the group is also asking the National Telecommunications and Information Administration to update a study last done in 1993 on the role of telecommunications in hate crimes. Last week, the coalition released a preliminary report by the UCLA Chicano Studies Research Center on hate speech in commercial talk radio. Former FCC Commissioner Gloria Tristani lauded the effort.
The rise in hate speech in the media and hate speech targeting Latinos, coupled with the rise in hate crimes targeting Latinos, cries out for a thorough, factual investigation into the extent and nature of hate speech and the relationship between hate speech and hate crimes.
Jessica Gonzalez from the Institute for Public Representation at Georgetown University Law Center, which is partnering with the National Hispanic Media Coalition, explains the groups are seeking a study, not any regulations on speech.
It will seek an examination into the extent and nature of hate speech in our media and options for counteracting or reducing the negative impacts of such speech.
Inez Gonzalez of the National Hispanic Media Coalition emphasizes that the petition does not call for a revival of the fairness doctrine. The National Hispanic Media Coalition insists the answer is not suppressing speech, but more speech. For more information, visit the National Hispanic Media Coalition's website at nhmc.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, coming to you from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. That's got a great show for you today. Our guest is Dean Baker, an economist with a PhD from the University of Michigan, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, author of numerous books for which he's been on this program for at least two of them. And we've got him back today with his most recent book, and I think perhaps his most timely and important, Plunder and Blunder, The Rise and Fall of the Bubble Economy, has foreword by Thomas Frank, another friend of the program, and we're going to be talking with Dean Baker this entire hour about that show. Dean, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here, and I just want to tell a little story before we get into today's show with you, Dean. I happened to be at a costume ball or costume party of all things last night, and everyone was supposed to come dressed as some major political cataclysm of the last 8 years, sort of celebrating that there was a new regime going in the country. And one person came in, and she's wrapped in bubble wrap, and she had a note on her that said, "Only Dean Baker can see me," and her costume was the financial bubble. And I think it was a testament to the fact that your assessment of the housing bubble and the financial crisis is now, I think, commonly recognized as having been really ahead of the curve. And now people also understand that you, as an economist and as an economic journalist, were reporting on the stock bubble, too, many years before the collapse of the stock bubble at the turn of the decade, the century. So it's an honor to have you here with a book that really captures some of your best writing on the two bubbles, your explanation for how you could see them and why other economists ought to have seen them and what we can learn from them. And if I can, Dean Baker, the first thing I want to say to you is I just noticed this morning in the news that White House advisor on the economy, Larry Summers, former Secretary of the Treasury, said it is going to get very, very, very bad very soon unless we do something dramatic. Do you share that sentiment?
Well, it is getting very bad. He's certainly right on that one. I'm not sure if what they have in the cards is dramatic enough, but the numbers that are coming out, the rate at which we're losing jobs, is just incredible. We had a report on Friday that we lost 600,000 jobs in January. We lost basically the same number the prior 2 months. I mean, it's just an amazing rate of job loss. And for some technical reasons, with the way they collect the data, I actually think we're probably losing jobs somewhat more rapidly, maybe 50, 60, 70,000 a month more than that. And it's an astounding rate of job loss. The economy is basically in a free fall. And you get this downward cycle where people lose their jobs. They obviously don't have money to go to the store and buy things. They're obviously not going to buy houses and cars. So there's further reductions in demand, which lead to more job loss. And unless the federal government, they're really the only ones in a position to act right now, can come in with a lot of money, we're looking at a really awful situation.
And I don't want to go too much into this right now. We'll talk about it during the show. And this is highly speculative. But during my lifetime, and I'm 56 years old, you know, we've had three, four, five recessions, starting in the one in the 70s, maybe. And the most severe, as I remember, it was the one in 74 or perhaps the one in the early 80s, were the two most severe I can recall. Yeah, it strikes me already right now that we're in a different zone than either of those.
Well, one of the sort of positive things, and obviously people lived through those and lost their jobs. I mean, I'd never make light of that experience. But the plus side of those recessions was we did know how to get out of them because those were deliberately brought on by the Fed raising interest rates. I should be careful here. I'm not saying they tried to bring on a recession, but they were trying to slow the economy by raising interest rates. But what that meant was that we knew how to get out. You lowered interest rates. So what happened when you raise interest rates, you make it more expensive to buy cars, to buy homes, buy other sort of big-ticket items, so people don't do that. But then when you realize you went too far, the Fed lowers interest rates, people haven't bought homes, haven't bought cars, big pent-up demand, they suddenly rush out to do it, and that gets the economy going again. So you could look back in the years following those recessions, 76, 77, or 83, 84, the economy was growing very rapidly, the unemployment rate came down quickly. So we had an easy way out of that. It was very painful while we were in it, but we knew the way out. This is a story. There is no easy way out. We got here because of a collapse of the housing bubble. We've had all this attendant problems in the banking industry because there was this whole mountain of debt that was built on bad housing debt. All of this is clogging the financial system. And the amount of lost demand due to both directly the housing sector and then probably more importantly the consumption that was carried on based on the housing world, that's simply huge, and there's no easy recipe to replace that. So we're looking at what could be a much, much more serious downturn than either the 74, 75, or 81, 82 recession.
Our guest, Dean Baker, author of the new book, Plunder and Blunder, The Rise and Fall of the Bubble Economy, just came out. A common, frequent guest here on Media Matters, and really an expert not only on the macroeconomy, the economy, but also an astute commentator on the way the press and the media, news media, cover the economy, which, as I discovered in reading Plunder and Blunder and knowing your work well, is one of the supporting themes in this book, that our news media, along with the other sort of tag team supporting character, the economics profession, both have been really negligent in their function of serving as a warning system for the American people.
Yeah, well, they should have been talking about these bubbles, certainly the stock bubble and the housing bubble. They should have been seeking out voices. I wasn't the only one. There weren't a lot of us. But they should have been looking at this critically. And in principle, you should be able, when you have, I'm not thinking of small-town newspaper, but when you have the Washington Post, the New York Times, the National Public Radio, these should be people that have the ability to make an independent judgment. So they should be able to look at the evidence, talk to experts, talk to economists who are telling them that everything's just fine. But they should be able to look at it themselves. And, you know, maybe I'm a weird guy, whatever. But there were other people. Robert Shiller was one of the top financial economists in the world, professor at Yale University. He was saying similar things. He was a little later than me, but I'll give him credit. He was saying similar things. So when you get a few people that are making arguments and we aren't obviously foaming at the mouth, you should have people at the major news outlets that could say, well, what's going on here? And for the most part, that didn't happen. I'll give the New York Times credit. They did have some reporters that did occasionally talk to me, talk to Robert Shiller and some of the other people who are raising questions. But you really didn't hear that on National Public Radio. You didn't hear it on the Lehrer News Hour. Certainly didn't in the Washington Post. The Washington Post, just astoundingly, they to this day, they still rely on the chief economist from the National Association of Realtors as their main source on the housing market. And that was certainly true all through the bubble. There was a person there named David Lira, who was the chief economist. And on top of that, one of his claims to fame was he wrote a book, Why the Real Estate Boom Will Not Bust and How You Could Profit from It. And they felt no qualms about relying on him very often as the only source in their article when they're talking about the state of the housing market.
You know, as you point out in the book, Dean Baker, which is maddening to me and I think infuriating to lots of people, the same economists who sort of dropped the ball and missed all this still have credibility. Like you said, not only by news media, but even by government. They're still taken seriously as people who know how to get us out of problems they got us into.
Yeah, well, certainly Larry Summers, who you had mentioned earlier, is one of the people in that would fit in that group who was one of the people who promoted these policies in the Clinton administration. He certainly was not out front in warning about any problems in the housing market after he left. So he gets one of the very top positions in economic policy under President Obama. And when you raise that, you go, well, let's look at his track record. I had a number of conversations with reporters and others, and they're thinking I'm being vindictive. Now, I guess I've met Larry Summers, but once I really know him, I'm very casually acquainted with him. It just seems to me that it's a reasonable thing to look at someone's track record. We do that in other professions. I just wrote something today saying, you know, a dishwasher messes up on their job, they get fired. A custodian messes up on their job, they get fired. an economist messes up hugely on their job, and you just don't talk about it. You just promote them.
Let's go back to a point, Dean Bick, you were making before we get on to telephone callers and sort of other pressing issues. But you mentioned how interest rates, which have been the standard way the government has slowed down or encouraged growth in the economy in the post-war years, and that's by a complicated mechanism, but in effect setting interest rates for the economy, with high rates sort of discouraging investment and consumption and low rates encouraging investment and consumption. That doesn't work now. That option is off the table. Can you explain a little bit more? Is this what they call the liquidity trap in economics?
Yes, and that's basically where we sit right now, because interest rates are short-term rate. The Fed has basically at zero. They set a target between zero and 0.25%. So that's, for all practical purposes, zero. Okay, it's not going to go any lower than that. And even the long-term rates on government bonds are very, very low. They've been around 2.5%. Actually, they've squeaked up a little bit. I think they're getting close to 3% now, but they're still very low. But it's very hard to move the economy any further with interest rates at this point. And that's why it's so important to have a big stimulus package, because that really is the only game in town. And if we look at, one, government policy, and two, where else we might expect the economy to get a boost, there isn't really anywhere else. So, again, with interest rates, pretty much the Fed having done all it could by way of interest rates, there's some other things it may be able to do, and we could talk about that in a minute. But in terms of straight interest rates, they've gone as far as they can. Now, in terms of other sectors of the economy, we might hope to give us a boost. It's just very hard to see. Investment is going through the floor. I originally had some hopes that investment looked like it was being sustained reasonably well, but the latest data on that show investment falling at the fastest pace since a very steep but short recession in 57. So that's not encouraging. Obviously, consumption is going to turn around as people are losing their jobs left and right and have lost, by my calculations, about $6 trillion of housing wealth, plus $7 trillion in the stock market. It's housing itself, of course, there's a huge glut of unoccupied homes, unsold homes, so housing market's not going to turn around. Commercial real estate is plunging. There was a bubble in commercial real estate that's bursting now. So, and the foreign sector, which actually had been a helpful sector, the trade balance had been improving 07 into this year, but that's just gone into reverse, primarily because everywhere else in the world's in a recession also. So we don't have an alternative at this point to having the government spend lots of money.
You know, that message hasn't seemed to have gotten to all the politicians in Washington yet. A lot of them seem to be missing it. But I just want to follow up on this before we get to that, what's going on in Washington, which is taking this low interest rate liquidity trap argument and sort of looking to the future. One of the themes that I see come up in the business press and among certain economists like Paul Krugman and Joseph Stiglitz, among others, that I don't see talked about by the politicians enough, which is sort of the doomsday scenario for contemporary capitalism, which is what the threat of deflation, of serious deflation setting in, if there isn't any sort of recovery. And what happened in Japan, but in a much worse scale. And perhaps for our listeners who these terms don't mean anything or they're unfamiliar with why this is considered a doomsday scenario for our economy, you could explain what this abyss is that they're looking at.
Well, there's a couple different deflation stories. The sort of real doomsday story is one where prices are falling rapidly. And we did actually see that at the beginning of the Great Depression. When I'm saying rapidly, around 10% a year. And the reason why that literally can be talked about the doomsday scenario is that no one in their right mind is going to invest today if prices are dropping at, let's say, 10% rate. So if we're thinking of General Motors or General Electric, whoever it might be, is going to undertake a big investment. They'll put out $1 billion. Well, that's not going to make any sense. If the products they're going to sell, it's going to take 2 or 3 or 4 years for their investment to come online, they're going to be selling prices that are 30 or 40% less than the prices they're looking at today. So that will never make sense for them because they're never going to be able to recoup their investment. And obviously, they're looking to make a profit. So you'll just see investment go absolutely through the floor and stay there as long as we have that sort of deflation.
And consumption, too, right? Because who's going to buy something today if you wait a year or two, you can get it for 20% less?
Well, I think that's somewhat overplayed because let's say that we're talking about prices falling 1% a month, maybe for a really big purchase for a car. You know, mm-hmm. Let's say a car that costs $20,000, you could save $200 by waiting a month, so you might do that. But for your typical items, I mean, even something that's fairly big, a TV set that maybe you'd spend $500-$600. I haven't bought a TV set for a while, so I don't know what they cost. But let's say you got, I think that's a pretty nice TV set for $600. So you'd save $6 by waiting a month. I don't think it has that much impact for anything except the biggest purchases. Of course, mm-hmm. houses, it has a big impact, obviously. You know, if you expect a house price to fall 10% over the course of a year, well, that's a lot of money, so people will delay on those purchases. But for smaller rates of inflation, deflation, I should say, I think this has been overplayed. So people talk about the deflation in Japan. I actually don't think the deflation there was particularly harmful. I think the deflation there was a symptom. It wasn't a cause, because the deflation rate, there may have been 1 or 2 years where it crossed 1%, but for the most part it was 0.5%, 0.6%. That just doesn't make that much difference from an inflation rate of 0.5%, 0.6%. And you had people jumping up and down going, oh, my God, they're suffering from deflation. Well, they had a weak economy. They had weak growth. But the deflation, to my view, was a symptom. It wasn't in any important way a cause of that.
The other thing I've heard that why deflation is a particular concern in our economy is because of the enormous amounts of debt that we have. That the debt, of course, as you point out, would increase in real value if price levels are coming down.
That's right. And certainly this strikes home with housing, that you have a lot of people that are now underwater in their mortgages. They owe more in the value of their house. So in large parts of the country, certainly the areas where prices had gone through the biggest run-up, that's now where they're in the biggest retreat. But in large parts, say California, Florida, it's very common to find areas where homes 3 years ago might have sold for $500,000, where typical homes today selling for $250,000. And if someone bought that home with $500,000 with zero down, as a lot of people were doing back in 05 and 06 at the peak of the bubble, then they're looking at owing $500,000 on a home that's worth half that much. Well, it's very unlikely they're going to pay that back, or they'll be able to. In many cases, they may decide they don't want to. They're better off just sending the keys to the bank.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Dean Baker, author of Plunder and Blunder, The Rise and Fall of the Bubble Economy, with a foreword by Thomas Frank. The book has just been released. I've had the privilege of reading it. I read a lot of economics for pleasure, political economy for pleasure, and for my research. And I can safely say that no economist writes more clearly on complex economic matters and makes them more accessible than our guest today, Dean Baker. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Dean Baker, the telephone number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Lines are presently open. Let's go back to Washington now, and you've been talking directly and implying at other times the need for significant government action to arrest this problem and turn it around. Dean Baker, Paul Krugman Friday in the New York Times had a column basically making a point you made earlier that the stimulus, if anything, is much too weak, that the Congress is currently considering are too weak, if not necessarily not much too weak. I think Krugman would say much too weak.
Yeah.
And secondly, the point he made, and I'm paraphrasing here, but basically the Republicans are insane. Can you comment on those two points?
Yeah, well, on the first one, I mean, people are looking at this, they're going, it's $800 billion. For a while I had it at $900, and that sounds like a really big number, but we have to put these things in perspective. First off, it's 2 years, and so what we're talking about is, even when it was at $900, it was $450 billion a year, and now we're talking about around $400. But what we have to measure that against is, what are we trying to make up? What's the demand gap we're trying to fill? And I just, you could do some back-of-the-envelope calculations. We lost somewhere on the order of $450 billion in annual demand because of the collapse of the housing sector. It had been over 6% of GDP. Today it's about 3%. So that comes to about $450 billion a year right there. On top of that, because of this, the wealth effect on consumption, people have lost on the order of $6 trillion in wealth. They're on their way to losing about $8 trillion, assuming the bubble fully deflates and may even overshoot. On top of that, the stock market's lost about $7 trillion in value. The wealth effect associated with the wealth effect on consumption associated with that decline in value in housing and stock implies a loss in annual consumption on the order of $650 billion a year. So you're losing $450 billion due to housing directly, $650 billion in lost consumption. That gets you up to $1.1 trillion. And then we're seeing the collapse of the non-residential, the commercial real estate bubble. That probably adds about another $150 billion. So we're talking about replacing on the order of $1,250 billion in annual demand with a $400 billion stimulus. And they want to cut it back further. So it's clearly not large enough. It's a very good, very important first step, but it's clearly not large enough. And the idea that the Republicans want to cut it back, I mean, I was making a joke about this because it's just kind of, you know, Paul Krugman was saying they're crazy, and I'd say exactly right. It's as though trying to save money on stimulus. It's sort of like if we were jogging every morning and we had a 4-mile route and we go, hey, I just found a shortcut. I mean, you know, it doesn't make any sense. You know, if you want to do 4 miles, you want to do 4 miles. And if we need to spend whatever amount of money, the idea that we're going to somehow save money, it makes no sense.
Well, let's go to our phone lines right now for our guest, Dean Baker. And let's start here with line 2 in Urbana. You're on the air with Dean Baker, author of Plunder and Blunder.
Hi. Just a quick comment. I was hoping to get your views on this. But as a non-economist myself, the whole idea to me of a constantly growing economy seems to set a crash like this up at some point when people are encouraged to spend money that they might not have. And it just seems like for several years there's been kind of an economic bubble all over the place where, you know, there's easier access to credit and people are spending more money than they really have. And to me, I don't see how this can be really sustainable on the long haul. And I just wanted to hear your comments. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Dean Baker?
Well, it's a very good question. Well, first off, what was clearly unsustainable was the sort of bubble-driven growth that we had over the last, well, certainly in the stock market, we go into the 90s, but more recently with the housing market in this decade. And that was unsustainable because it was premised on house prices continually rising. And it made sense. I mean, people's consumption, people buying things, they could do that as long as their house price continued to rise. So if you had a house that cost $250 and then the next year it's worth $300, well, of course, you know, nothing wrong with spending $10,000 of that new equity as long as it keeps going. But the problem was it wasn't going to keep going. So that was the big problem, and that certainly was unsustainable. Now, more generally, can we have an economy that's always growing? I consider myself quite an environmentalist. I've done a lot of work in areas, aspects of environmental economics, and what I've always argued is there's no direct relationship between economic growth and resource use. We could have a growing economy that's growing because we're using less resources. We're installing more energy and energy-efficient windows, so we use less energy in our houses. We develop the Internet so we don't have to transport ourselves around the country to go to meetings, or maybe we only have to go to work 2 days a week. There's all sorts of ways in which we could think of where you'd have economic growth associated with less resource use rather than more resource use. So I'm a fan of economic growth. I'm not a fan of environmental degradation, and I don't think the two have to be related. There certainly have been many times historically in many places and even here where they very much are related, but that's something we have to change.
And Dean, just to follow up on that, if you're going to have a capitalist economy can't really exist without economic growth, can it? I mean, without economic growth, you have basically depressions or recessions.
Well, it's a good question. If you envision a situation where you had a declining population, and there are some countries in the world that face that situation, they may end up with very low rates of growth without necessarily having recessions, depressions, because if you have a declining population, of course, you have a declining workforce. So I'm not sure. I mean, I guess we'll just have to see what happens there. There's all these people running around claiming gloom and doom for countries like Japan and Italy, which now have declining populations. And I'm afraid I just don't see that. I guess we'll have to see. We'll know better when we see it.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Our guest again is Dean Baker, author of Plunder and Blunder. I'm Bob McChesson. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. Let's go now to line 1. Urbana, you're on the air.
Hi. You were earlier talking about what else the Fed can do, and, you know, the motivations of the Fed are important. But I've been hearing this term called quantitative easing, which is what they're supposedly doing. I have a sense that it's probably a whole battery of things that they do that's under that heading, and some of them might be less good than others. So I wanted you to sort that out for a little bit. I watched Summers today, and one of the things that came up, and I haven't read this anywhere, I don't know if you've commented on it, but one of the strategies for the so-called toxic assets is, instead of this bad bank idea, a la Sweden or some other interpretation of it, is actually subsidizing equity funds or underwriting their purchases of these toxic assets. Now, that sounds terribly suspicious to me. It sounds like, and unless there's some kind of clawback, as they like to call it, which is a curious term of art, too. But if you're following that idea. And then just on Summers himself, on Fox News, he commented at least 3 times about talking about the mess we inherited or something to that effect. And I don't know if he's been challenged anywhere directly. about how he is one of the co-creators of it, and he can't just say that he's coming. Why doesn't he accept that he has to admit that he's? Well, anyway, I'm just ranting. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I understand your point there. All right, we'll take them in order. Quantitative easing, this just refers to a departure from the Fed's normal policy tool. Ordinarily, the Fed just controls the short-term interest rate, literally overnight interest rates, the rate that banks charge each other to borrow reserves that they need to meet their mandatory minimum. That's their ordinary tool. That's basically zero. They've done all they could on that. So what else can they do? Well, they could intervene directly in longer-term, buying longer-term bonds, and they've done that a little bit, buying mortgage-backed securities, and that's reduced mortgage interest rates. They had been up near 6, and now they've been creeping up a little bit lately. They had been as low as 5. I think they're about 5.25 now. So they could just get right into those markets and buy up huge amounts of mortgage-backed securities if they choose to do so. And in that way, lower the mortgage interest rate. They could do that with other types of securities, too. They could do that with car loans. They could do that with commercial paper for private corporations. They've actually done that to some extent. So they could directly influence other interest rates in the economy. And the downside of that, I mean, it's a plus side that will obviously facilitate lending, help the economy. But the downside is that this is, in effect, you're subsidizing different sectors. And keep in mind, the Fed is not Congress. They're not really answerable to anyone, so they get to say, well, we want to have more housing, because that's what it means if you're going to lower interest rates. Is that who you want to subsidize? We want to let people get mortgages at a lower interest rate? We may want to do that, but that's a conscious decision to subsidize one group of people and implicitly not others. And I've made this point. I'm not necessarily hostile to homeowners. I don't happen to be one at the moment. I have been in other points in my life. But suppose someone's got a $400,000 mortgage, obviously a well-off person, relatively well-off in the scheme of things. Well, if the Fed comes in there and lowers the interest rate by 2 percentage points, which is a ballpark number of what some people suggested, they're in effect handing $8,000 a year to that person. And is that really, should we be expecting the government to hand $8,000 a year to someone because they own a relatively expensive home? What about someone who's getting by in $15,000 or $20,000 a year? They'd probably like $8,000 from the government, too. So there are important issues there that people should be mindful of. So it can be a powerful tool, but there are also some very important distributional issues, as well as economic issues, that should be considered. The third point on Summer's responsibility, there's still a real cover-up, I would say, in the media, and I don't mean in a conspiratorial sense. I just a failure, really, to come to grips, primarily because reporters, for the most part, still don't think about what has happened. So Summers should not be able to get away with the problems we inherited. Now, on the one hand, they did. President Obama inherited horrible problems. On the other hand, Summers was one of the people that created the groundwork for this set of problems. So he should not be able to say with a straight face the problems that we inherited. On the other hand, whoever he said it to, I don't know who the host was there, they probably don't have a clue, so they didn't know that they should be challenging Larry Summers. You know the old line about chutzpah, the definition of chutzpah is the kid who kills his parents and then pleads for mercy because he's an orphan. And, you know, Summers is a little bit in that case, that if he's going to say, oh, we inherited these problems, no, he helped get us on this path. Now, that doesn't in any sense remove blame from President Bush and Greenspan and all the others who had ample opportunity to change that path. But Summers helped get us here.
Dean Baker, before we go back to the phone lines, I'd like to just follow up on that and talk a little bit about the bailout of the banks and how the Obama administration is looking at dealing with the bank crisis right now. I had on this program Sherrod Brown, the U.S. Senator from Ohio, in mid-December, and basically he acknowledged that when the bailout package came before Congress last September, I think it was, or early October, that it was more or less like they walked into the senators felt like they had someone with a gun at their temple saying, you either pass this or we will kill the world economy within 48 hours.
Should know better. That was not the story. Let me go into a couple of things there. First off, just so people understand.
Let me be fair to Sherrod. I'm making those words up. Those aren't his words.
Well, okay, I'll clarify a little bit because I didn't talk to Sherrod directly around this, but I was talking to many members on the Hill and their staffers. But first off, just so people be clear, what's at stake right now? The banks are bankrupt, and we should probably say that about 50,000 times. The banks are bankrupt. So when people are talking about, when President Obama and others are talking about how we're going to deal with their troubled assets. What they're really talking about is how can we keep them afloat when they're in fact bankrupt without making it really obvious that we're giving them taxpayer dollars. There was an article in the Washington Post today that was talking about one of the problems with these plans to buy up their bad assets is we might pay too much. That's not a problem. That's the point. They want to pay too much because if we paid the correct price, if we paid the market price, the banks would be bankrupt. They'd have to own up to that, and they'd be out of business. So what they're trying to do is hand money to the banks and pretend it's something other than handing money to the banks. And that's why it's so difficult, because the obvious thing to do is simply to take them over, and then you get all these people saying you want to nationalize the banks. I go, no, I want the market to work. They're bankrupt. And a bankrupt company is taken over by a bankruptcy judge. Bankruptcy judges don't work well in operating large banks. So what we would have to do is have the government step in and, in effect, run them, get their books back in order, and sell them back to the private sector. So that's actually the market solution. They don't want the market solution. They want the government welfare solution. They're trying to find ways to hand money to the banks without that being obvious to taxpayers.
I guess that was the point I was trying to get at with Jared's comment. In the conversation with him was simply that that they're really the system reeks of basically being primarily concerned with helping the shareholders and executives of banks and financial institutions rather than with protecting the interests of the American people and the taxpayers. And that I think was what he was alluding to, and I didn't do a good job of summarizing.
No, Sherrod's a good guy. No, Sherrod, no, yeah, I generally respect his positions. I think he's trying to do the right thing there. But just to clarify what I saw happening there, you obviously had a serious situation with the financial system at that point. What they were trying to do was say, if we don't act today, everything's done. And they were saying literally today. There was, I think Bernanke at one point said, next week will be too late.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a mushroom cloud over the economy.
Because even after Henry Paulson had full legal authority to act, it took him 10 days to do a damn thing. So obviously he didn't quite see it that way, or he would have acted sooner. So one, the urgency was not as much as they said. But secondly, they created a situation for members of Congress where if they voted against the TARP and it was defeated, they were going to be blamed for every bad thing that happened. And if you recall, it went down the first time. The House of Representatives voted down the first time. The stock market plunged about 10%. And then you had all these news stories, these stupid morons, these stupid Neanderthals. They don't know anything. Look at what they did. They just destroyed over $1 trillion in wealth, as though we should ever make policy based on what the stock market does in any given day. It's about the stupidest thing I ever heard of. But they're beating them up. You know, they just destroyed over $1 trillion of wealth. They better turn around and pass this thing. And for members of Congress, they were presented with a situation where if they voted against that and it went down, they would get blamed for every bad thing that was going to happen. And I had to tell them, lots of bad things are going to happen. Now, on the other hand, if you voted for it, it didn't matter what happened. No one got blamed. I haven't heard a single member of Congress called a stupid Neanderthal because they voted for the TARP. And look at what's happened. We just lost 600,000 jobs last month. Those people voted for the TARP. Must be real stupid Neanderthals. No one said that. You know, so the media set this up as a totally one-way proposition, and you had members of Congress who were raising exactly the right objections. Why are we giving money to banks? Why don't we demand that their executives all take big pay cuts? We give them money. Their executives all took bonuses and everything, and you got all these guys running around like the lieutenant in Casablanca. I'm shocked. Well, no one was shocked. I was telling these people there's nothing there to prevent them from just taking big pay. We didn't put restrictions on dividends. We could have done that. So the people who were against it were raising all the right objections. They're being steamrolled by the opposition with the total collaboration of the media in this country, where they just really gave members of Congress, even very good people who I have a lot of respect for, they gave them no choice. I can't tell a member of Congress they should cast a vote that's going to cause them to never get reelected. And that was the choice they had at that point.
I don't know if you're familiar with the book that Kevin Phillips wrote about financial capital and the financialization of capitalism. But in it, I think he suggests, it's been a few months since I read it, and I've been reading a lot on this recently, so I hope I'm doing a good job of paraphrasing him, that one of the great developments in politics with the increase of the financial institutions and real estate and insurance in our economy is that they've increasingly gravitated to the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party is now the party of finance capital. We traditionally associate the Republicans as being the party of big business, and that may well be true still. But that the bankers really have done a good job of becoming the party, the top financial or moneyed interest in the Democratic Party. Do you think there's something to that? Would that explain why the Obama administration seems so reticent to do what Joseph Stiglitz and yourself and others have called for, and what a lot of other countries are doing, and just, you know, accept that the banks are bankrupt and take them over?
I think so. I mean, the financial industry clearly has a lot of influence in the Democratic Party. Certainly Robert Rubin was in many ways a symbol of that during the Clinton years. But even after that, I remember several different times I was at meetings with Hill staffers and talking about different issues, and someone would say, well, what does Bob have to say about this? And unfortunately, Bob was not you. I wish it was.
Then I would have called you up.
You know, but it was really quite striking. It came to be a joke that I had that my goal in politics here in Washington was to get Bob out of the room. I'd never been in the room with Bob, but, you know, somehow. So, they have enormous influence within the Democratic Party, and I think this explains the very roundabout way that President Obama is looking to bail out the banks, because it's bad economics, and I think it's horrible politics, and I think it's really an unfortunate decision to do at the same time that he's pushing for a stimulus that we desperately need, because a lot of people confuse those. Obviously, most people aren't following the news very closely. They sit down for a few minutes, catch the evening news, or they read through the paper quickly. They hear about this bailout with hundreds of billions to the banks. They don't like that, and very often for very good reason. And they don't necessarily distinguish that between the hundreds of billions that we're talking about for stimulus that we actually do need. So you have a lot of people that they're thinking, yeah, I don't want that money stimulus, and they're not realizing, no, that's about creating jobs. That's not about handing money to bankers.
Dean Baker, our guest, we have several callers that have been waiting patiently, and I apologize for hogging the microphone today because I'm so interested in this subject, and I'm so delighted to have this guest here. I can't help but pester him with my own questions. But let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 3, Champagne, thank you for your infinite patience, and welcome to the air. You're on with Dean Baker.
No problem. You're doing a nice job. I read today Frank Rich's commentary in the New York Times, and normally Frank Rich is a supporter of President Obama, and I'm a supporter of President Obama and Frank Rich. But today, Frank Rich took out at Obama for, one, being very poor in terms of political skills since he's in his infant administration, and two, primarily on the economic policy. The question I got from Frank Rich was, why did President Obama choose the likes of Larry Summers, have Robert Rubin and his transition team, have choose Tim Geithner, and I think the guy was going to be over commodities, when it seemed to Frank Rich and myself that these are all people that are part of the whole mess in the first place. How would such an astute politician like President Obama find himself caught up with this gaggle of insiders who were part of the problem? That just perplexes me.
Yeah, well, I think it's one of these things we're going to have to be dealing with over the next, well, I have to say, hopefully 8 years. President Obama, in many ways, my lifetime, probably the best president I've seen. I shouldn't say probably is, but he's answerable to, he answers to different constituencies. During the campaign, he actively courted the Wall Street people because they were very important to his campaign. They gave a lot of money to his campaign. They have a lot of access to the media, and he picked advisors during the campaign who were very closely tied to Wall Street. Summers was working on his campaign back through the summer months. He was a very active figure. So Obama's gotten in the habit of turning to these people, and it would be a real radical move on his part to have a break with them. Those are the people he's been talking to. Those are the people he's getting his advice from. I don't know if he hears what Joe Stiglitz or I or Paul Krugman are saying. You know, Krugman's got a very good megaphone in his New York Times column, so maybe he does see some of that. But, you know, the people he's been turning to have been the Larry Summers, the protégés of Robert Rubin. And he does have a few people, I will say. A friend of mine, Jared Bernstein, is an advisor to Joe Biden, and I gather is often in the room, so I assume he speaks up. And he does have a few voices, but there's no doubt about it. The predominant voices that he's hearing are people who have close ties to Wall Street, and I think that's not the direction we want to be going right now.
Our guest, Dean Baker. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. Dean Baker, author of the new book, Plunder and Blunder, The Rise and Fall of the Bubble Economy. The phone number here, 333-9455, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to yet again another very patient caller waiting. Muhammad, line 2, you're on the air with Dean Baker.
Yeah, I'd like to ask Mr. Baker, what about the specifics of the new stimulus bill? I mean, what about the $60 million for the arts, and over a half a million for the STD program and the pre-kindergarten program. I mean, none of these things seem like a stimulus to me. Please explain the things in the stimulus package that, to you, make no sense.
Well, let me just be clear. There was a lot of confusion. I wish that Obama's people were clear on this, and the Republicans have really exploited this. Spending money is stimulus. It's sort of like we could argue if we sat down and we had a table full of different types of food, we could argue, is this good food? Is it bad food? You know, maybe you don't like the meat or you don't eat meat or whatever. You know, we could sit there and look at all the different things on the table, but they're all food. And spending is stimulus. So if we pay people to clean up the mall or to provide family planning or to, you know, do some artwork, whatever we pay them for, we've created jobs, and that's stimulus. That's what it means. Someone's going to have a job who didn't previously have a job. They're going to have money in their pocket, which are then going to go to the grocery store. They're going to pay their rent, and that's going to be further stimulus to the economy. So whether or not it's good, we could argue over. But the fact, spending is stimulus. It's that simple. Now, then we could look at the specific items, and some are good, some are bad, and frankly, an awful lot of them I don't have the foggiest idea about. And one of the things that the Republicans have specialized, Democrats have done this too, so I won't make it a partisan issue, but many politicians have specialized in finding some small item, and here I'll pick on Senator McCain as my prime example. He went around the country yelling about the Woodstock Museum that cost the taxpayers all of $1 million. Now, $1 million is a lot of money to me. I doubt I'll ever see that in my lifetime. Most of us won't. It's a lot of money to me. For the federal government, that's 0.3% of the budget. We don't have time worry about every $1 million as to whether it was spent good or spent bad. We hope it is. We hope it's spent well. But we don't have enough time. If we were to worry about every single $1 million item in the budget, we'd be through the whole year and not even get through 1/10 of the budget. So we have to hope that people had good sense, and I really couldn't tell you whether that $1 million for the Woodstock Museum was a good idea. It's easy to ridicule, but for Woodstock, New York, my guess is they aren't going to get any jobs from anything other than a Woodstock Museum. So it really may not be a bad use of public money. But in any case, if you look at the big items there, they're about providing health insurance for unemployed workers, about providing Medicaid for poor people, about getting money to state and local governments so they don't have to lay people off, about fixing our infrastructure that's been badly neglected, about retrofitting buildings so we use less energy. Those are the big items. So the fact that we could find this or that item that might sound really bad, might actually be really bad, I just can't get that concerned about because it's a tiny, tiny fraction of the whole bill.
Let's go back to the phone lines. I believe our next call, if I follow the nomenclature correctly, is Urbana, line one. You're on the air with Dean Baker.
Call kind of mirrors the last caller. It's a question about there's been this, I don't know, belief in that just tax cuts are stimulus. And I'm not sure if that's spending money or not. I know that when I get a tax cut, it's, you know, one of the few times in some of the Bush rebates that I actually have extra money and I can stick it in my pocket. And that's what I do. And I suspect that people who are just kind of, you know, not making tons of money are in that situation. And it seems like corporations, when they get tax cuts, they use it to pay bonuses to their employees who, you know, invest it and you know, send it away. I don't get how this is stimulus. And I think Obama challenged that idea to a point, but maybe not as far as he could have last week in a speech. And I'd like your take on that.
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. Again, there's a lot of economic evidence on this, and that's why it's just sort of frustrating to have to keep arguing. And you're just going, what are we arguing over? There's a lot of economic evidence from people across the political spectrum. I mean, one of the people who's been prominent saying that tax cuts will not stimulate the economy is Martin Feldstein, who was the chief economist under Ronald Reagan. He's perhaps the most prominent Republican economist in the country. And he looked at the tax cuts last summer, and by his analysis, less than 15% of the tax cuts were spent. I actually think somewhat more. I think he underestimates it. But nonetheless, the point is, here's a very conservative Republican economist who says we can give people tax cuts, they won't spend it. That's always a problem. It's particularly going to be a problem right now when people have just seen so much wealth disappear. The plunge in housing values to date translates into about $80,000 on average for every homeowner in the country. So when someone thought they had, let's say, $150,000 in equity in their house, and now they find that they just have $70,000, and let's say there's someone in their 50s a few years from retirement, they're scared. They're not going to run out and we send them a $1,000 check or whatever it might be. They're not going to run out and spend it. They're going to try and save what they can. So it's not going to be a way to stimulate the economy. So just saying tax cuts, tax cuts, tax cuts, it's just kind of silly. We have to look at what's going to have an impact on the economy. And right now, tax cuts are not the way to do it.
Let's go back to the phone lines if we can. Now let's go to Champaign, line 3. You're on the air with Dean Baker.
Hi, Dean. Great to have a chance to put a question to you. I'd like to ask about a recent New York Times article that I believe you're familiar with. I think you commented on it on your website. But my question refers to the analysis of Japan's fiscal stimulus programs in the 1990s. And the argument on one side was that it had not worked. It was sort of an anti-Keynesian argument. On the other side, the argument was that they hadn't done enough, and that what they did specifically was too much oriented towards infrastructure and not enough towards social services and education, and that social services and education would better address economic growth. So referring to what you were talking about just a couple callers ago, that stimulus is stimulus, is there not a better type of stimulus? And should we be worried that the Republicans looks like they were trying to take out money on the education side, on educational infrastructure, and put more money into things like highway building, bridge building, et cetera?
Yeah, no, certainly there are things, there are better ways. There's two things. One is that you could have money that's spent that isn't real stimulus. I'll say that in a second. And then there's certainly better ways, sort of more useful things that we might be able to do with it. And I think healthcare spending, for example, is a very, very useful type of spending. Highway spending can be useful if it's repairing roads. If it's building highways that are going to lead to more sprawl, we may not want to do it. And in terms of stimulus, if we have to start the highway from scratch, well, we aren't going to be able to spend that money this year. We'll be lucky if we could spend it next year because it takes a long time to plan a highway. Now, in terms of the situation with Japan, one of the stories, and I will claim no expertise on this at all, I just know that many economists who do know it much better than I do have raised this point, that a lot of what was supposedly stimulus, the highway construction, was simply buying up land. It was they would appropriate money for a highway, and money would be shuffled around, and what would actually go to build the highway might be many years down the road and a small fraction of what they actually had paid out. So if we take, just throw a number out of the air, if we take $10 billion and we say we're going to build highways, and only $3 billion goes to build the highway, and the other $7 billion goes to buy land from people, well, we'd be foolish to think that's going to stimulate the economy to any great extent. And the stories I've heard is that much of what was written there, it looked like these were these great big stimulus programs, were really just money going to people to buy land. And obviously the people who saw the land were, of course, delighted, but that wasn't a way to boost the economy. So I'm very much of the view that basically Japan didn't do enough. And I should point out, by the way, Japan's story isn't a great story, but it's not quite as bad as people sometimes think, because on the one hand, they had a reasonably good social safety net. I'm not going to say a great one, but reasonably good. And their unemployment rate never got much over 5%. So they weren't sitting there with double-digit unemployment. So you didn't have mass starvation, mass homelessness. It got bad there. I'm sure the people in Japan, many of them were not happy. Many of them suffered. But it was not like the Great Depression here. And the other point to keep in mind, when you see Japan having very low rates of growth, we were just talking a moment ago about how, or I was at least, about them having declining population. We have population growth of around 1% a year, which means just to more or less have everyone stay even, we have to have roughly 1% a year GDP growth. Well, in Japan, where their population has basically been stagnant for 10 or 15 years, well, if they stay even, then everyone's just as well off. If they have 1% GDP growth, well, that's 1% more per person. So I'm not going to say they've had a great record since 1990, but I think we can exaggerate. They did not have the Great Depression. No one there would have mistaken Japan's situation in the 90s for the Great Depression.
We have several callers still trying to get through. I'll try to get to all of you, so I'm going to ask each of you to be brief if you possibly can. Let's go to Urbana, line 2. You're on the air with Dean Baker.
Would you comment on the Washington Mutual Bank's bankruptcy? The president in 7 years made over $70 million, and he did that by giving out loans to people with no collateral. As long as he got his commission, that was all important to him. And he knowingly and willfully drove the company into bankruptcy, and I think he should have gone to jail. That would have sent a message to the other bankers who do such things that they cannot get away with such actions. Thank you.
Well, it's a very good point. We've really seen that across the board, where we had bankers making huge, huge amounts of money on very short-term gains, carrying through transactions that led to, in many cases, led their companies to ruin. Obviously, were horrible for homeowners that suddenly got caught in a vice with mortgages they couldn't pay off. But these people are walking away with their money. I'm hoping. I mean, we can't put them in jail for being, you know, basically being assholes, but
Watch your language here, Dean.
Okay, excuse me for being unpleasant people. But I would hope that prosecutors would go through what they did with the fine-tooth comb, because if they lied, if they misrepresented things in corporate reports, then that is fraud, and you are supposed to go to jail for it, and I would love to see a lot of these guys go to jail.
Let's go now to Bloomington, line four. You're on the air with Dean Baker, author of Plunder and Blunder.
Yes, good afternoon. A fiscal stimulus of $1 billion would add to our current national debt, which, depending on you, how you calculate it, is currently between $10 billion and $50 billion. Do you view hyperinflation as a long-term legitimate concern?
I think it's very unlikely. It's very hard to see the scenario where we get to hyperinflation. Of course, right now people are more concerned about deflation. I'm not as concerned about deflation. I think we probably will see some modest inflation. I think the biggest problem is not our debt, our budget deficit, or national debt. It's pure and simply that we've had a large trade deficit because the dollar was overvalued. So I expect the dollar to fall at some point. It's been rising recently because of the crisis, but I do expect that to turn around. That will lead to modest inflation. I'm saying modest. I'm thinking 3%, 4%, not double-digit, and certainly not hyperinflation, which is in the hundreds of percent. I don't think that's in the cards. Now, one thing I should point out, when people go around with $50 billion, there's been this whole group who've been $50 trillion, I'm sorry, yelling about the long-term deficit. It's really very misleading. This is all because of our broken health care system. We have a health care problem, and that looks like a deficit problem because we pay for half of our health care through Medicare, Medicaid, and other public programs. If we fixed our health care system, we have no problem. So these people, if they were honest, would be talking about our health care problem. If we got our health care system working like Germany's, like France, like Canada's, pick your country, we'd have surpluses.
Dean, there's a whole group of politicians and pundits who think that the budget deficit, the federal budget deficit, and the national debt is the killer of the economy. It causes the current crisis, and unless we solve it, we'll always be in depression or crisis. Are you a budget hawk, or what do you make of that line?
It literally makes no sense. I mean, we're in this crisis because we had a housing bubble that burst, and you could point to other problems with the economy, but the budget deficit actually wasn't that bad. I wish it were a little bit lower than what it had been in the Bush years, but it wasn't that large relative to the size of the economy. And again, this is the sort of scare tactic that people can get away with because most of us, of course, aren't looking at the budget the whole time. We aren't looking at the economic data the whole time. So when we hear a budget deficit of, we go back to the Bush years, $300 or $400 billion, that's a really big number. Of course it's a big number, but the relevant question is, how large is it to the size of the economy? And for the most part, it was 2 or 3%, which is, again, my view, probably a little bit larger than it should have been, but it was not devastating. So this idea that we had some enormous budget problem, that simply isn't true. It was bigger than it should have been. The deficit was bigger than it should have been, but not hugely so. And the long-term problem is pure and simply health care. If we could get our health care system fixed. But the point is, these people don't want to confront the doctors. They don't want to confront the insurance industry. They don't want to confront the pharmaceutical companies. They'd rather beat up on senior citizens. So they go around, we're going to be real tough. We're going to beat up grandma. And that's, to my mind, just contemptible.
Let's go to a last call. Champagne line one, if you can make it extremely quick, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, I'll try. This is a question about Washington insiders or Wall Street insiders. Don't we need some insiders, not with the same beliefs, but repentant Wall Street insiders, because they understand the system? Can you really fix things with outsiders?
Yeah, Dean, and to add that the Madoff scandal certainly points to that sort of direction.
Well, it would be good if we had some repentant insiders because they do have knowledge. But in some cases, the knowledge that these people have is perhaps knowledge of things that we really don't need that much of. So, for example, someone who's very good at manipulating credit default swaps and some of the more complex derivative instruments, I'd like to see those markets largely shut down because they weren't helping the economy in any very big way. But it would be great if we had some repentant insiders. I'm just not sure if that's a really long list of people at this
point. Dean Baker, on that note, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I hear the band tuning up. They want to clear me out of the studio. It's been great having you this hour, and we'll be in close touch with you in the months and years to come. Dean Baker, author of Plunder and Blunder. I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Kyle Kroha for working the board, Bob Naiman for sitting in today as the producer. We'll be back in 167 hours. Have a good week, everyone.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio, adjacent to Campbell Hall for public telecommunication.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, mostly sunny skies today with a high of 44 degrees. Tonight should be mostly clear with a low of 36 degrees. Monday, a chance of light rain showers, otherwise mostly cloudy with a high reaching 55 degrees. Monday night should be mostly cloudy with lingering showers, a low of 44 degrees. You are listening to WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.